Good afternoon, comrades. Welcome to our Sunday afternoon discussion group, hosted by the Consistent Democrats. This week we are discussing Lenin's State of Revolution, Chapter 5. Personally, I've really been looking forward to this chapter because it really started to get into the nature of the state and what it means once it eventually disappears. Anyhow, I'm going to start to talk for about 40 minutes and then we will be having a discussion. Those on video, if you would like to speak, you can just use your physical hand and I will see you. For those not on video, please use your virtual hand and I'll call you to speak. Remember, please bear in mind that we are being recorded, so when you do speak, please try to keep it to one at a time and try not to talk over each other. Okay, Ian, the floor is yours. Take it away.
Hey, thank you, Paul. Can everybody hear me all right?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. Well, it probably won't be 40 minutes. It might be a bit less, but we'll see anyway. But in my opinion, this chapter is quite magnificent, and it's the core of this work by Lenin. And the chapter, and arguably the book itself, is a restatement of a crucial work by Marx, which was never published until after Marx's death. And that is the Critique of the Gotha Programme. It was published in 1891, whereas Marx died in 1883. And it's in four discrete sections, which stand together in explaining this subject matter in a fairly straightforward but rich and subtle manner. It explains the stages of the emergence of socialist society as of capitalism by means of the dictatorship of the proletariat, and then the later emergence of communism itself as of the socialism that it's possible to build today. And there's no need to reinvent the wheel or go into a learned set of extended theses on this, so I don't propose to go through this in great depth, but rather to give a sketch of the main points. But what I would advise, however, is to study this chapter in particular several times. It contains the political ballast to not only understand the whole of Lenin's small book, but there's also a linear progression from some of the material, particularly in section 3 of this book, to understand Trotsky's The Revolution Betrayed, which we studied earlier. And another point that's worth noting is that none of this is developed in terms of any particular national terrain. It's taken as given that we are discussing the overcoming of capitalism as a whole and not any nationally isolated posing of the question. And in this regard, this citation from Marx, I think, is significant. He says this, he says, "The different states of the different civilized countries, in spite of their motley diversity of form, all have this in common, that they are based on modern bourgeois society, only one more or less capitalistically developed. They have, therefore, also certain essential characteristics in common. In this sense, it's possible to speak of the present-day state in contrast with the future, which in its present route, bourgeois society, will have died off." And that is from the Critique of the Gotha Programme. Hang on one second. It's clear that this is about developed capitalism in its entirety, and none of this implies any national isolation. There's a more any perspective of socialism in one country. So the first part of the chapter is titled "The Presentation of the Question by Marx." And Lenin briefly looks at two letters. Marx's letter to Wilhelm Bracker of May the 5th, 1875, and Engels's letter to August Bebel on March 28, 1875. Which address basically two facets of the same question in different ways. the nature of the state in the immediate aftermath of a working class revolution. So Engels argues against Babel, who was fond of agitation in favour of such things as a people's state or a free state, that the state was not a weapon of liberation, but something that our aim is to abolish. And Engels argued that socialists should stop using demands about the state in agitation and instead talk about the community. Whereas Marx had written at some length about the future state in communist society, which would seem to imply the opposite of Engels's argument. Lenin pointed out that they were just emphasising particular aspects of their joint views to address different questions and were united in their basic position. So Lenin thus quotes Marx. He says, Marx says, "The question then arises, what transformation will the state undergo in communist society? In other words, what social functions will remain in existence that are analogous to the present state functions? This question can only be answered scientifically, and one does not get a flea-hop nearer to the problem by a thousandfold combination of the word people with the word state." So there you have the three-pointed scientific answer Marx produced, and which Engels elaborates and popularises in his work. So Lenin quotes Marx as saying this. He says, "Between capitalist and communist society lies the period of the revolutionary transformation of one into the other. Corresponding to this is also a political transition period in which the state can be nothing but the revolutionary dictatorship of the proletariat." He continues and he says this. He says, "Previously the question was put as follows. To achieve its emancipation, the proletariat must overthrow the bourgeoisie, win political power, and establish its revolutionary dictatorship. Now the question is put somewhat differently. The transition from capitalist society, which is developing towards communism, to communist society is impossible without a political transition period, and the state in this period can only be the revolutionary dictatorship of the proletariat." So Lenin notes such achievements as the SPD, which in organising, as he says, a larger portion of the workers into a political party than anywhere else in the world. But there's 1 million in the party itself and 3 million in unions out of 15 million. And yet, notwithstanding that, he says this. He says, "If we look more closely into the machinery of capitalist democracy, we see everywhere in the petty, supposedly petty, details of the suffrage," in brackets it says residential qualifications, exclusion of women, etc., "in the technique of the representative institutions, in the actual obstacles to the right of public of assembly, i.e. public buildings are not for paupers, in the purely capitalist organisation of the press, etc., etc., we see restriction after restriction upon democracy. These restrictions, exceptions, exclusions, obstacles for the poor seem slight, especially in the eyes of one who has never known want himself and has never been in close contact with the oppressed classes in their mass life. And 9 out of 10, if 99 out of 100, bourgeois publicists and politicians come under this category. But in their sum total, these restrictions exclude and squeeze out the poor from politics, from active participation in democracy." And Marx grasped this essence of capitalist democracy splendidly when, in analysing the experience of the commune, he said that the oppressed are allowed once every few years to decide which particular representatives of the oppressing class shall represent and repress them in Parliament. Right, so Lenin notes that capitalist democracy has this character and does not proceed, as the opportunists say, towards greater democracy. Instead, he says this. He says, forward development, i.e. development toward communism, proceeds through the dictatorship of the proletariat and cannot do otherwise, for the resistance of the capitalist exploiters cannot be broken by anyone else or in any other way. Simultaneously with an immense expansion of democracy, which for the first time becomes democracy for the poor, democracy for the people, and not democracy for the money bags, the dictatorship of the proletariat imposes a series of restrictions on the freedom of the oppressors, the exploiters, the capitalists. We must suppress them in order to free humanity from wage slavery. Their resistance must be crushed by force. It's clear there is no freedom and no democracy where there is suppression and where there is violence. And he quotes Engels to Babel. He says, the proletariat needs the state, not in the interests of freedom, but in order to hold down its adversaries. And as soon as it becomes possible to speak of freedom, the state as such ceases to exist. And thus, he further elaborates, he says, furthermore, during the transition from capitalism to communism, suppression is still necessary, but now it is the suppression of the exploiting minority by the exploited majority, a special apparatus, a special machine for suppression. The state is still necessary, but this is now a transitional state. It's no longer a state in the proper sense of the word. For the suppression of the minority of exploiters by the majority of wage slaves of yesterday is comparatively so easy, simple, and natural a task that it will entail far less bloodshed than the suppression of the risings of slaves, serfs, or wage labourers, and it will cost mankind far less. But he says there is a fundamental difference between this and the bourgeois state. Because there, as he says, the exploiters are unable to suppress the people without a highly complex machine for performing this task. But the people can suppress the exploiters even with a very simple machine, almost without a machine, without a special apparatus, by the simple organisation of the armed people. The machine is the armed people. That's what he says. We're talking about a semi-state. So Lenin goes, and he's doing this with Marx in a sense, into the first phase of communist society. Again, he quotes Marx in saying this. He says, what we have to deal with here in analysing the programme of the Workers' Party is a communist society, not as it's developed on its own foundations, but on the contrary, just as it emerges from capitalist society, which is in thus every respect, economically, morally and intellectually, still stamped with the birthmarks of the old society from whose womb it comes. And in particular, he notes that the revolution expropriates capitalist property, and each worker receives the share of the products of society proportionate to that which they contributed. This is formal equality. So he goes into that, and he says this. He says, the means of production are no longer the private property of individuals. The means of production belong to the whole of society. Every member of society, performing a certain amount parts of the socially necessary work, receives a certificate from society to the effect that he has done a certain amount of work. And with this certificate, he received from the public store of consumer goods a corresponding quantity of products. After a deduction is made of the amount of labour which goes into the public fund, every worker, therefore, receives from society as much as he has given to it. But he points out that this is not real equality, because the individuals receiving these equal shares are themselves unequal. So he says, but people are not alike. One is strong, another is weak. One is married, another is not. One has more children, another has less, and so on. And thus, he says, this is an application of an equal measure to different people who are in fact not alike, who are not equal to one another. And that's why the equal equal right, in quotes, is a violation of equality and an injustice. In fact, everybody having performed as much social labour as another receives an equal share of the social product. So what this leads to is a paradox, that under the dictatorship of the proletariat, and even under the lower stage of communism, such inequalities, which Lenin acknowledges are unjust, are still inescapable and can't simply be wished away. And this phenomenon Marx and then Lenin calls bourgeois right, in quotes, and it's part of material reality. And Lenin again quotes Marx as to why that is. Marx said, these defects are inevitable in the first phase of communist society, as it is when it has just emerged after prolonged birth pangs from capitalist society. Law can never be higher than the economic structure of society and its cultural development conditioned thereby. And so thus the state, and even the bourgeois state, or part of its social function at least, cannot be abolished by decree alone. It continues to exist, and it must continue to exist in some form, until social development renders it superfluous in a more distant future. And so he elaborates, he says, in its first phase or first stage, communism cannot as yet be fully mature economically and entirely free from traditions or the vestiges of capitalism. Hence the interesting phenomenon that communism in its first phase retains, in quotes, the narrow horizon of bourgeois law. Of course, bourgeois law in relation to the distribution of consumer goods inevitably presupposes the existence of the bourgeois state, because law is nothing without an apparatus capable of enforcing the observance of the rules of that law. So it follows, he says, that under communism there remains for a time not only bourgeois law, but even the bourgeois state without the bourgeoisie. And that became a crucial issue after the Russian Revolution, when the working class conquered power in a huge, backward, an overwhelmingly peasant country. Because although the state was, in formal terms, the owner of the entire collectivized economy, the bourgeois state without the bourgeoisie, as he put it, had its power enhanced by the difference of material productivity between Soviet Russia and its imperialist enemies. And the only basis which the power of this necessary apparatus could have been diminished was by a harmonious development of the productive forces, which presupposed the joint efforts of the proletariats or the working classes of several advanced countries. But, of course, with the first materially backward workers' state plunged into political isolation, this bourgeois state without the bourgeoisie, which Marx spoke of and which Lenin actually amplified or expanded on, became relatively more powerful against the mass of the population, against the working class, in a sense. And they were able to, this apparatus was able to politically expropriate the working class while maintaining the property relations of the proletarian revolution for several decades. And in a sense, this is all explicable and explained by this chapter in essence and in embryo. But the flip side of it, of course, is that given a sufficient development of the productive forces, the state, including the administration of distribution that we're talking about, obviously ceases to be economically justified. And Lenin goes into this in some depth, and I will actually just quote quite a chunk here. He says, democracy means equality. The great significance of the proletariat struggle for equality and of equality as a slogan will be clear if we correctly interpret it as meaning the abolition of classes. But democracy means only formal equality. And as soon as equality is achieved for all members of society in relation to ownership of the means of production, that is, equality of labour and wages, humanity will inevitably be confronted with the question of advancing further from formal equality to actual equality, i.e. to the operation of the rule that says, from each according to his ability, to each according to his needs. By what stages, by means of what practical measures humanity will proceed to this supreme aim, we cannot and do not know. And he says, when the majority of the people begin independently and everywhere to keep such accounts and exercise such control over the capitalists who are now converted into employees and over the intellectual gentry which preserve their capitalist habits, this control will really become universal, general and popular, and there'll be no getting away from it. There'll be nowhere to go. And the whole of society will have become a single office and a single factory with equality of labour and pay. But this factory discipline, which the proletariat, after defeating the capitalists, after overthrowing the exploiters, will extend to the whole of society, is by no means our ideal or our ultimate goal. It's only a necessary step for thoroughly cleansing society of all the infamies and abominations of capitalist exploitation, and for further progress. And just to conclude this, I'll quote this section, as I think it does actually capture this very well. He says, from the moment that all members of society, or at least the vast majority, have learned to administer the state themselves, have taken this work into their own hands, have organised control over the insignificant capitalist majority, over the gentry who wish to preserve their capitalist habits, and over those workers who have been thoroughly corrupted by capitalism, from this moment, the need for government of any kind begins to disappear altogether. The more complete the democracy, the nearer the moment when it becomes unnecessary. The more democratic the state, which consists of the armed workers, and which is no longer a state in the proper sense of the word, the more rapidly every form of the state begins to wither away. So then the door will be thrown wide open for the transition from the first phase of communist society to its higher phase, and with it to the complete withering away of the state. Thank you, comrades. I'll conclude with that because I think it really does actually conclude the chapter pretty well. And I'll open it up for discussion. Cheers.
Thank you, and that was a very good talk. Who wants to make a contribution?
It's all right. Paul. Yeah, Paul.
Yeah, I thought since nobody else currently wants to talk. I did notice that actually, and not for the first time actually, that Marx and Engels, in some of their previous works, and also in this Lenin work, it seems to me that many people today use the words socialism and communism as interchangeable, when actually, if you look at what Marx and Engels said, and then later Lenin, in the stuff that he quotes, it seems to me that Marx and Engels and Lenin made some very clear distinctions about the differences between socialism and communism, and that's in part why I found it interesting that, contrary to what people think, Marx and Engels did talk about the various stages that one would have to go through in order to finally reach what we would call communism. So I thought that was interesting in itself. Thanks.
Anybody else? Actually, you're sharing, are you?
Come on, comrade. Is somebody speaking?
I think Max wants to speak. Mark.
Oh, Mark! Mark got his hand up. I take Mark out, and then I bring Max in. Mark, you're unmuted, but we can't hear you.
Technical problem again, perhaps.
It's
too...
on video, so...
What did he say?
Oh, go to Mark first, and then I'll come back to Mark.
Sure.
Go ahead, Max. Hello.
Your sound is dead as well.
He's got the wrong earpiece by the looks of it. I think...
Interesting.
I can hear Mark 8. I think that Mark 8 system suddenly woke up.
Oh, right. Okay. Can you hear me now?
Yeah, perfectly.
Yeah.
This will sound very anal, but this is very interesting to me, the transitional stage between capitalist state to communist state. Where could I find the source where that's gone into more detail as to how that can occur?
Ian?
Well, I can come back on that. I mean, there's a pamphlet. This is the pamphlet by Marx that Engels said that Lenin is using for a lot of this stuff. It's called The Critique of the Gotha Program. And it's not huge. It's a small pamphlet. Again, it's a critique of the original program, the German Social Democratic Program Party, going back to the 1880s or 1890, I think 1891 or something like that. You know, bit earlier than that actually, in the 1870s. But it was only published in 1891. I think that's right. But it was a critique that was circulated internally. In the SPD, as it was the main party of German social democracy, as it was being created in the earlier period, and it was quite a complex and messy process, as I understand it. But Marx's pamphlet was key to cohering the Marxist wing, as it were, of a much broader party. But yeah, if you look at the Critique of the Gotha Program, that is worth looking at, you know.
Will do. Okay.
Will that be in the Marxist Internet Archive?
It will be, yes. It is. It definitely is. Yeah.
Okay. Mark, do you want to give it another go? Nope, we can't hear anything.
You need to test your...
Hear me.
Here we are.
I can hear you now, yeah.
He's alive. Yeah,
he's going straight through the air without the headphones. Apparently the headphones are shit. I'm trying to remember why. My question was inside my own head, like why this is... What's the point of this chapter? Or actually, I understood... as a whole, the book State and Revolution, like decades ago when I read it, and now I'm reading it and saying, okay, what are we talking about? And I'm realizing as we speak about my questions being answered that I don't understand about what this whole Gotha program thing is. I never really read any of that stuff. Various Spartacist type people would mention it, in their polemics, with their screaming. In the meetings back in the 80s, people actually stood up and yelled at each other, which is refreshing compared to what's going on today. It's like almost nothing, but that's a separate matter. But I remember it being mentioned, and I remember thinking, oh, there's some more stuff I don't know. But you now, is that the only context that this – it almost feels like, what are we talking about? You know, well, okay, it's the state and revolution right after the revolution by Lenin. So it must be important. But I personally right now, I'm trying to figure out why. I mean, it's theoretical. But I mean, what's the point? I think it's important. I'm guessing that it's counterposed to some ideas, some other socialist ideas that are incorrect, attenuating back to the German social democratic, which I don't know. I'm guessing. Is that true or am I wrong?
On that positive note, do you want to come in on that, Ian?
I would like to come in, yeah, because I mean, my point about this is there are two very good reasons for studying this. And one is connected to the problems of social democracy today. It's not so much the problems of the SPD in the 1870s or whatever. We are facing certainly in Britain, we've been facing a situation since the formation of your party or the attempt at formation of your party, when we have to deal concretely with the problems of social democracy and reformism. And why there are, how we can argue that to go beyond that and to actually build a party that is not reformist, that is not parliamentarist, and which doesn't actually indulge in parliamentary careerism as a way of life. You know, we're trying to get out of that. And we're propagating we're not the only left-wing group, even in your party, who have been discussing this. The Bolshevik tendency have been discussing it as well. They've held up a couple of meetings in Lewisham, which unfortunately I was never able to get to. But I think they've more or less bailed out of your party now, which is unfortunate. But the idea is the same, i.e. that we want to go beyond parliamentarism. We want to have a party of class war and not of class collaboration. Explaining some of these issues and debating them is a crucial element of this. What are we seeking to do in terms of fighting for socialism? We're not seeking to get obviously we want to fight against the capitalists and against the far right and against the various bourgeois parties in front of the working class in the elections. But our ideal is not simply another reformist, or in practice reformist governments tend to become neoliberal governments these days, you know. We want to explain to people and to promote discussion on how to go further than that. And this is almost like the manual of it, of how to deal with it. Because we're things like the Paris Commune, for instance, the ethos that every worker's representative should be paid the same as a normal ordinary worker, and be subject to recall if they mess things up or if they betray their constituency. That is integrated into this work, into Lenin's State and Revolution. It's an integral part of it. But this actually explains it in terms not just of practicalities like that, but also in terms of final goals and what we're aiming for. And that's why we're going into some detail in this. We have actually studied this for each chapter by chapter when we've had time over the last several months, you know. And this is the last but one chapter of the book. It's not a huge book, but it is, you know, it is worth studying for those reasons. That's why we're doing it. Anyway, I'll leave it there. And I think Paul wants to come back.
I think with the power of commune, I think in the chapter really, there's a sort of lesson as to why it sort of went wrong in a sense, isn't there? Because I think in the chapter it talks an armed proletariat, doesn't it? Well, as far as I remember, unless I'm wrong about it, I think it was still under the control of the French state in reality, so it wasn't a state in its own right. And the other, of course, is that the people in the commune, if I remember rightly from what, although I wasn't there at the time, but the people in the commune, they were unarmed, weren't they? In which case, it was destined to fail in that respect. It would have been part of the French state, if I understood that correctly.
Yeah, I think so.
Ian?
I think so, yes. I mean, I think. Well, it's debatable, but I think that sounds reasonable, put it that way. You know.
Ian back.
Yeah, sorry about that. My connection failed for a minute. I sort of half heard what you said, but the connection was playing up.
I was talking in the sense that in the chapter, I felt that there were some important lessons with regards to the Paris Commune, because I think in the chapter, Lenin talked about the need for the proletariat to be armed in order to defend the proletariat state. But my understanding is that where the Paris Commune fell was on... sorry, Mark, can you mute yourself, please? Mark's sound is... My understanding is that the Paris Commune fell on two fronts. One, it was part of the French state in reality. And I also believe that in the commune itself, the people in the commune were also unarmed. Is that correct?
Could I just come back on that? Because the answer to that is not really. I mean, the Paris Commune was armed. It had a National Guard. The Paris National Guard was effectively a workers' militia, and it was, if you read Marx's The Civil War in France, it was based in the north of the city in Montmartre. That was the centre of the commune, and it was an armed formation, and there was actually a conflict over the arms of the National Guard, an attempt to actually disarm it by the Versailles regime, by the regime of Thiers. Was a key confrontation of the commune. I think what was wrong with the commune is it was limited to Paris, and they didn't really have a concept of expanding it to the whole country. It sort of happened almost by accident. The power fell into the hands of the working class without really being, you know, planned for. And and once it fell into the hands of the working class in one city, they didn't really know what to do with it. They organised on a more or less correct basis in the framework of that city. But really, they had to go and take... What they should have done is marched on Versailles and sought to destroy the existing regime. That would possibly have brought them into conflict with the Germans as well, because the Germans... The reason that opportunity had arisen is because Germany, under Bismarck, had just defeated Louis Napoleon. And the French Bonaparte regime had collapsed, and so the various politicians who were trying to reconstitute French capitalist regime, they were struggling to regain power at the same time as power had fallen into the hands of the working class within one city. And if they'd been serious, if they'd seriously been prepared to do this, they should have just marched on Versailles and stamped out the Versailles regime, and they would have actually been able to take power in the whole of France if they'd done that. but they didn't think of that. They weren't, it wasn't planned. It was something of an accident that this happened, and they weren't really ready for it. So they actually let it lie. And then there were, of course, Versailles struck back, and the commune only lasted for 2 months, unfortunately. And there was a huge massacre afterwards. 50,000 workers were basically done away with, you know, in Paris. What is the purpose of discussing this? Well, I think it's, I mean, we weren't really discussing the commune as such, because the commune comes up in previous chapters in some depth in this book. But this chapter is not particularly about the commune per se, but it's about all these things flow together. You know, our audience is people who want something better than social democracy. And there are many of them, including people like Zara Sultana, who calls for a party of class war at the beginning of your party in that great rally in Liverpool. She called for a party of class war. She called for opposition to NATO, a whole range of things which are excellent. And we you know, you need the theoretical ballast to do this. And with very limited means, our comrades have tried to do it. And we've actually initiated these discussions, but with very limited means. So that's our audience, you know. We're not just discussing it for the sake of it, though it is worth discussing anyway. The recording is still going on, by the way, I believe, looking at this. Yes, it is.
Yes, it is. When you came back on, the recording turned itself back on, it seems. So...
Yeah, I think it probably was still on because...
No, it wasn't because when your connection unceremoniously cut off, the recording stopped.
Ah, okay.
When you came back on, it came back on again.
I'll have to edit the recording. <It's a> bit... Yeah. Okay.
Max, is that a legacy hand?
What?
Is that a legacy hand, or did you want to say something else?
I forgot that it was up, but I'm having some. No, I was just trying to figure out what the context was. Not, I wasn't asking what your audience is, I was asking what Lenin's audience was, just in trying to figure out why. I'm just trying to answer. It kind of, it's like when I read parts of Capital in a reading group a few years ago, actually with DSA comrades, but online it's different. It's not like a meeting. Anyway, I would like, it's feel like he would go belabor these points to the point where you're like, you get your eyes glazed over and you say, oh, I can't be a communist. It's like physics. It's like, do I really have to understand every word? But because it's part of state and revolution, I can't just say, nah, it's just something I don't understand, because I remember that book as affecting me profoundly. So I just feel like I'm missing something. And I think it has to do with that Gotha program where, or maybe it's like, oh, okay, this is some kind of a counterpost to somebody who's saying, no, it's not the withering away of the state. It's maybe the state being replaced for different purposes or some other version of, you know, how we get from capitalism. So I think maybe that's what I'm trying to figure out, like, why is this, you know, why is this not just almost semantic? Of course, when things change, we're going to have a different way. But it also seems kind of utopian, as if, because obviously, like in real life, where has the state ever withered away in a transference from capitalism to communism in the actual world we live in? Maybe somewhere, I don't know, but maybe in Granada, I don't know. That's the question. It's like, is this just theoretical? Because it didn't happen. Or maybe this was what they were. I'm just trying to figure out who they're talking to. If you're talking to a bunch of DSA members in New York City, of course, they use electoralism, and they pretended that some of them even pretended. I've met people that say, oh, because Lenin said this and that, and they're pretending to be doing it Leninist tactically, but they weren't really. They're actually doing it, you know, they're actually playing along. So anyway, I don't know. I guess, yeah, they had the same kind of issues 100 years ago, but we, I don't know. I'm getting lost in my own babble here, but I personally have had a kind of a falling out. I personally have just personally have fed up with electoral politics, probably because I experienced such bad abuse of it in the last 10 years in the United States. Oh, just because it's just like, yeah, once you get somebody like Trump marching in there, you know, I don't know about electoral. It's like, we got to get rid of the fascists. Even if we don't have a socialist revolution, we have to do something along that way. You know what I mean? You can't vote. It gets to a certain point where it's like, you're not going to be able to work within the system on this guy. You know what I mean? But that's irrelevant, really. That's just like applying the worst case scenario, I guess. I don't know. So.
Yeah. Diana.
Yeah, how does a state wither away in isolation? Because my suspicions about why the Russian state never withered away, it wasn't given a chance. Because as soon as you get a state with a revolutionary population and installing a revolutionary communist, socialist, communist type system, it gets attacked quite viciously. I mean, Cuba is a classic example. But I mean, it wasn't just Cuba, the USSR was under horrendous attack from the outside. So when you've got that, doesn't that kind of force the existing bourgeois state to remain in existence as a way of self-defense? Mm. It looks like Cuba is an interesting case because it does seem to have set up the kind of grassroots democratic systems that's needed, but the state can't wither away because it's under attack.
Sure. Can I come
back? You want to come in
on that? I mean, there's no way that Cuba, the state in the Soviet Union, could wither away, and that's the whole point. Because, as I said at the beginning during my talk, this is not about one country. It's not. It is not a program of national isolation, and that's not what Lenin is talking about. And in fact, at the time he wrote this, which I believe was at the beginning of 1917 or the end of 1916, there was no question of socialism in one country. The whole idea of socialism in one country didn't really come into to become a something that anybody seriously argued for until around 1923, 1924. You know, the assumption in all this is that that capitalism would cease to exist not just in one backward country, but in a whole series of countries, and that they would be working together to actually develop the productive forces and actually take society forward in a joint effort. You know, that's the unspoken, it's sort of mentioned. He makes it clear that he's not talking about any one country. He's talking about general social development. And he's talking about a situation where capitalism is no longer the dominant force in the advanced world. That's what Marx and Engels were talking about. That's what they were envisaging, and that's what Lenin was envisaging as well. Because he didn't think that he remember Lenin gave a speech in about, I think it was in 1915. He said something like, "We of the current generation will probably never live to see the revolution." And then within a couple of years, he was in power. You know, and they didn't really expect that to happen. You know, so what he was talking about was the need for socialism on an international level and how it would work out. You know, his audience, of course, was the mass memberships of the European socialist parties who had been, you know, whose leaders had betrayed the international struggle in the First World War and herded millions of workers into the trenches to fight each other, including in Russia, actually, you know. And that was part of the thing that caused the war to, that caused the backlash against the war, I should say, that led to the Russian working class taking power in the weakest part of imperialism, the weak link, as it were. But he didn't envisage it being in one country. And so, yes, you're right. I mean, Diana is right. There's no way that the state in Soviet Russia could wither away. And that's why it degenerated, you know, because that bourgeois state without the bourgeoisie, the thing that administers the post-capitalist economy, became stronger and stronger the more isolated it became and the more it was driven into its own productive resources, which were very limited at that time. There's a lot more. Russia is a lot more powerful today, in terms of productive power. But it's unfortunately it's not so. It's not a workers' state anymore. At least not in the classic sense. There are some remnants of it, but no. You can't. The state can't wither away without the joint efforts of several countries, of the most advanced countries, to actually push the productive wealth of that society beyond the most advanced capitalism. And then you'll see the possibility of the state withering away, you know. And it becomes objectively necessary, in fact, for the state to wither away, because the state becomes a barrier to further advance, you know. But at this point, there's no way. I mean, even less Cuba. Cuba is 90 miles off the American coast. The working class never took power in the classic sense in Cuba, though it did actually, by other means, obtain a collectivized economy that was similar to that of Soviet Russia in many ways. But it wasn't even a revolution where the working class consciously took power in the way it did in 1917 in Russia, in the big great cities of Moscow and Petrograd. And other places, actually. Cuba was a guerrilla war, created a kind of a worker state, yes, but there's even less possibility of that withering away. If a revolution happened in the United States, then the Cuban worker state would wither away because it would no longer be necessary to defend itself against the United States. Obviously, the United States would be dead. It would be a worker state, you know, or whatever, across the Caribbean or whatever it is, you know. But there's no way that that can happen today. No. And that, you see, that's the whole point. But things are changing. I mean, we are in a situation where imperialism is suffering major defeats, you know. It's under a lot of stress itself. And I think there's a lot of differences between the world then and the world today, but the audience is similar. It's people who want to escape from, who want to fight against capitalism and go beyond sort of democratic reformism or what passes for that these days. Yeah. I don't know if that makes any sense.
Does anyone else want to come in?
Yeah, Max.
That's a legacy hand. I think he's
what? Boy, I'm having technical problems today here.
Mm-hmm.
I can't buy equipment. A lot of the problems I'm having is because my mind is focused on some other things that are unresolved about all these versions of of working within the electoral systems for socialists. And after years, I still don't. I always have to refer to some newspaper or somebody else. I can never see it for myself. It's very frustrating. It's like, am I stupid? I don't think it's because I'm stupid, but it's a very important question. And whatever was talking about when he wrote that 100 years ago, whatever's the same, there's got to be things, examples today that we should focus on. And that's what I'm trying to figure out. Like, okay, I had a feeling. I don't know why I had that feeling. But when you guys were talking about your party, we'd be reading this meeting would be about, you know, state, whatever. But you'd mentioned your party. And I said, why do these people care about it? You know, because my feeling was, it's just another dead end. Now, I don't know that much about British politics. And I think you straightened me out a little bit, Ian, a couple of times. I said, no, it really was a valid thing. Okay. So my problem is, why do I have this reactionary feeling? Well, probably because I experienced a lot in the United States with the, you know, Jesse Jackson, all these coalitions and blah, over the years against Reagan and fight the right and all this strident graphics. And a lot of times it's just more, you know, Bernie Sanders is talking about revolution. Part of me wanted to believe it 10 years ago, but it's usually bullshit. Actually, it sounds like I need to teach myself more about other countries' politics. Because I'm starting to realize this different elections have different meanings. I understand the principle of voting for the one because it gives you leverage after that election, not because you fully support it. I understand that. My problem is recognizing which thing is that and which thing is just more careerist, you know, a way to, like Bernie Sanders, is a way to take the potential revolutionary energy of the masses and turn it towards liberal, you know, inside Democrat politics. You see, I'm more wary of that than I am, so probably like your party is not, it sounded like that came, like got corrupted from the outside. It's a different phenomenon. It's a different history. I'm starting to realize just because I felt that way doesn't mean I'm right. So I'm starting to this.
Ah, okay. Okay, Jonathan, you got the floor. Go ahead.
I don't know. It's just that, you know, I mean, this was written over 100 years ago. And it should be looked at in this context, and why some of the discussion in it is so odd is because history since 1917 has taken some funny twists and turns that couldn't have been anticipated by Lenin or anyone else, and has thrown up things and. So the theory of the state in Marxist terms has not really been advanced on much since that time because of the nature of the events and because of the thing. And so the stuff it's discussing is a bit far removed from our time, which is a very different time. And so, you know, I mean, this speculation about withering away the state and all that's of its time and isn't really, I mean, it was an important question for Lenin, all this, you know, at the time, because he thought that that the possibility of socialist revolutions we'd reached that period now, you know, we'd reached the period of wars and revolutions, as he said. And he thought it was going to take that turn. But because of Stalin and the development of world capitalism, it didn't. So a lot of the stuff in there sounds quite far from removed from the world that followed and the world that we live in today.
I'll take Diana and then I'll bring Ian back in. Diana, go ahead.
Looking at what I put in the chat, aids my memory. There's got comment about Corbyn killing your party, but I think that's looking at it too narrowly. There's a pattern. As you look at your party and the Green Party, first of all, the Labour Party, what happened in the Labour Party, and then what's happening in the Green Party and what's been done to your party, there's a pattern. We're not allowed to have an anti-Zionist, anti-fascist mass party with people standing in the elections. Maybe we need your party was intended to be a mass movement as well as is aimed at being a mass movement as well as being a political party which standing people in elections. Whether or not it stands people in elections, I don't know whether that would make a lot of difference to the way it's being sabotaged. We are not allowed to oppose fascism. People have been arrested for opposing fascism by standing up for criticizing the genocide in Gaza is opposing fascism. Recognizing the fact that the government, there's an artificially imposed government in Ukraine, which is a Nazi government, is opposing fascism. And there are a number of people, British people, not just British people, this isn't confined to Britain, but there are a number who are either living in exile or unable to return to this country because they are opposing fascism in that they are standing up for the people of Gaza or standing up for the non-Nazis in Ukraine and Russia. So I think there's a deeper, more universal problem than saying it's, you know, it's just a problem that's a hitch in your party. It's across Britain, but it's not even confined just to Britain. Similar things are happening in Germany and other European countries. So I'm not sure how coherent I've been anyway.
Ian, do you mind if I comment before you?
Of course, carry on. You're the chairman.
But I understand Danny's wider point, but I disagree with her in the context of your party, because in the context of your party, I really do think that Corbyn and his internal clique were directly responsible for that sabotage. This was before other layers of the state got involved. The state hadn't even got that far, as far as I'm concerned. This is Corbyn, Kelly Murphy, and all the Corbyn clique that ended up being elected as part of the CEC. they were directly responsible for that. The state hadn't even got the file across your party. They did it themselves, as far as I was concerned. And we could kind of rescue it from them. How successful that will be is another question, but nevertheless, it is an ongoing battle. That's my take on your party. In any case, Ian, sorry.
Yeah, I'll just come back briefly. I mean, I think, you know, that you could easily make a case that the issues that are addressed in this pamphlet have knock-on effects. Even the fact that they were not addressed and that they were not actually, you know, sort of dealt with, have had knock-on effects on the 20th century and the 21st. You know, from what John says, yes, this stuff seems esoteric because it's out of the experience of the current generation, and Lenin lived in a time where he appeared that the revolution was immediately on the agenda, and that situation has not recurred since in the same way. That is all true. But in reality, I think that if you compare the revolution betrayed, and if you compare what has happened in subsequent events to the Soviet Union's degeneration and the creation of clone versions of the Soviet Union in places like China and Cuba and Yugoslavia and whatever, you know, I think there is a causality of the degeneration. You know, you can see where the degeneration of the Russian Revolution came from by examining this stuff, the whole stuff about the need for a development of the productive forces in order to abolish, to see the state wither away, carries with it the converse implication that if you get a revolution where the productive forces are not able to develop in that manner, you open a huge can of worms. And I would argue that can of worms was indeed opened by the isolation of the Russian Revolution and the that bourgeois state without the bourgeoisie became immensely powerful. And that is Stalinism, effectively. And there is still a forward momentum. Even today, the ruling class fears the Russian Revolution. It fears China. Even though China is very different, it is still being mobilized against on a Cold War basis, which has its origins in 1917. And I think that's partly true of Russia as well. Russia is not the same as China. Russia actually did see the revolution overthrown in 1991. But the problem is they had the level of productive forces, of the development of the productive forces that happened over three quarters of a century since 1917 under a non-capitalist workers' state has left it with a legacy where they couldn't actually, it really was not possible to roll it back. And so you've got this sort of funny situation now where there's been a partial retreat of the counter-revolution, in my opinion, you know. And the level of hatred of the imperialists for Russia has not diminished. It is still the same. They're mobilising against Russia on a similar level of hysteria. It might be slightly different in the way they emphasise it. They do perceive that Putin is not the same as Brezhnev in exactly, and so there are mutations in the way it's justified. But nevertheless, the level of Cold War hysteria that's going on today against Russia and China is really, you know, not that different, in my opinion, you know. And that's because there's enough of the revolution surviving in Russia through the apparatus of the workers' state, which they've not been able to do away with, even though they've done away with key aspects of the dictatorship of the proletariat. It's a bit like what they said about, you know, what was it that It's proved to be a little bit like what happened after the Battle of Waterloo, when the revolution in France was overthrown. Napoleon was overthrown by people who would have liked to restore the old regime, and then they found they couldn't. It doesn't work. You know, I think that's a bit like what's happened in Russia, and the post-capitalist regime in Russia. I think Trotsky underestimated Summer back again. Hello? Can people hear me? I'm afraid the internet today is awful. It really is awful. It's the worst I've known it for quite a while. But what was I saying? Yeah, I mean, about Russia. They found they can't remove it. They can't just erase it. Even the counter-revolution in Russia could not erase the 70-odd years of development, just like that. Just as in after the Battle of Waterloo, in a way, they couldn't go back to the old regime. It was not possible. And I think that Trotsky was a little bit wrong. He thought the overthrow of Stalin would lead to a capitalist chaos and a rapid regression, and it proved not to be true because it was delayed by many decades. Of course, is that the Soviet Union survived longer than the Second World War by about 40 odd years, you know. And by the time it was overthrown, it was not so difficult to do away with it, really. And that's what's happened. So, you know, we're in a funny situation now, but it's still, in a way, Russia still stands on the shoulders of 1917, and so does China, but in a way that's not what you would have predicted, you know. So I think that we have to deal with the world as we are. I think Vicky is gone, hasn't she? No, that's a shame.
Yes, unfortunately, yes.
I'll give her a ring in a bit. I don't know what happened there. Maybe her internet failed as well. Anyway. Sorry, I'll let others come in anyway.
Yeah, I could say at this point, there are a couple of comrades that haven't spoken yet. So, you know, Emma and Mark C, is there anything you'd like to say? Because I noticed you haven't spoken and I don't want you to feel left out, you know. So if you've got something to say, please raise your hand and I'll bring you in. Jonathan, do you want to come back in?
Or was that just no. Not only does the present Russia and China stand on the shoulders of 1917, so does much of the Third World. Mm-hmm. You know, they've also benefited from the Russian Revolution and are still benefiting in some ways, and that's all I wanted to say.
Mm-hmm. All right. Yeah. What are we going to do now? Does anybody want to speak on? You carry on, Paul. Actually, you're cheering, aren't you? But I'm a bit disoriented because
Does anyone else want to speak? Obviously, there are a couple of comrades who haven't spoken at all yet, so I'm quite anxious that they get the chance to speak. But if not, we might have to think about bringing it to a close. Well, Matt wants to speak again. Go on, Matt.
You've lost your connection. You lost your sound, I should say.
Hear me now?
Yeah.
Yeah, we can hear you now.
Just wondering when the next meeting's going to be. And we'll, if
usually in 2 weeks' time, but it depends on what crops up.
You don't know. Okay. Yeah. So, is one more chapter in this book? Are we going to do that?
We are going to do that. Yes, yes, yes.
Yeah, because I want to make sure.
A little while.
I think I got to read the whole. I got to read the whole book straight through, and get my head screwed on, because I keep coming to these meetings like kind of half not remembering what the hell we're talking about, and it's very frustrating because it's a very good group.
Sure.
My own damn fault, as they say.
Okay, comrade. If you wish to speak, please indicate now. Otherwise, if it's okay, and I suggest we put the recording off.
The recording is not on, I've suddenly realised. I think this recording is on.
Yes, it is.
It is on.
Oh, it's
I can see it on top of my screen. Yeah. So, okay, could I do a summing up then, if no one would
speak,
and then we'll... Okay, comrades, it's been a very good discussion. Those of you on the mailing list will get an email with the next topic of discussion in due course. Thank you all for coming. And we'll hope to see you next time. Thanks, comrades.
I'll switch the recording off.